Congress, whatever our party or philosophy, have a role to play in defending and advancing our democracy. Our forebears set the example. As you may know, my own great-grandfather, August Shuckman, in 1849, sailed to America on a ship named Perseverance. He persisted against all the odds and made it to Sacramento 3 years later. And yes, we too will persist against storms and turmoil, obstacles great and small. The spirit of democracy never dies. It's alive in this chamber, in the hearts of Californians, and in people throughout the world. Let this be a great year for California, for our nation, and for our future. Thank you.
Governor Jerry Brown giving his final State of the State address in Sacramento today. Brown struck a reflective note throughout much of his 30-minute speech. He remembered when he became governor the second time around back in 2011.
It's now hard to visualize or even remember the hardships, the bankruptcies, and the home foreclosures so many experienced during the Great Recession. Unemployment was above 12%, and 1.3 million Californians lost their jobs. The deficit was $27 billion in 2011. The New York Times, they called us the coast of dystopia.
Well, Brown spent a lot of time on his favorite topics, the environment, transportation, education. He also vowed to defend Republicans who voted for a controversial gas tax increase and again justified his high-speed rail project, which has not gone very far. The cost keeps ballooning. We're going to look at how Brown evolved from when he was first elected governor back in 1974 to now. But first, here to talk about Brown's speech today and what we might be able to expect in his final year in office is David Siders. He covers California politics for Politico. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, what did you make of the speech today?
Well, unusually long, for one thing.
30 minutes. Yeah, that's
struck
long.
Most people. Yeah, and that's certainly a difference from when he was governor before. Didn't he do one at 7 minutes the first time?
Yeah.
But I think what was striking was how he balanced the view of Washington. So Brown has been cautious in how he approaches Trump and this conflict that everybody in the room and everybody on the rostrum with him is thinking about. But Brown's always been cautious about it. So it was largely today this implicit, critique of Washington by holding California out as, a more enlightened version of politics than Washington, a state that will do things like high-speed rail and climate change, as opposed to what's going on elsewhere.
Right.
And I think that's what was striking to me.
Well, so high-speed rail, I mean, that has been his priority for, ever, it seems, or at least in the last two terms. And it really hasn't gotten very far.
No, in fact, he was talking about high-speed rail, or his Caltrans people were, back when he was governor before, and courting investors from Japan for a project that never took off. So on both high-speed rail and the peripheral, well, now it's the tunnel, but what was the peripheral canal, really two major infrastructure projects that he'll leave office, I think, with the future uncertain, at least. So today was a rallying cry and lobbying to, I think, his successor, who might have been on stage with him if Gavin Newsom wins, to go forward.
Well, what can we expect going forward in this final year from him?
Well, I think on the infrastructure, you'll see Brown continue to press ahead. The thinking of proponents of this project is that the more that you lay track and build bridges and employ people and whatnot, they think the benefits will be seen locally and that it will generate more support. Also, it buys time because ultimately the project almost certainly needs more federal investment, and that's not happening with this Congress. So that's what you'll see on high-speed rail. But I think in the broader sense, what Brown's year is this is a final year on climate change. I mean, that's really become more his legacy than these two projects. It's certainly what he's been emphasizing more the last couple of years. And he has that big conference in September in San Francisco, where he'll gather people from around the world to talk about climate again. And so that's what to look for from Brown. The only thing to watch that might counter that is, so far, Brown's avoided any of this kind of lame duck syndrome that most governors face in the last year. And that's in part because he's a unique governor and in part because he has a ton of money in his bank account. But at some point this year, we'll start to see attention shift to the race to replace him. And I'm not sure how early that comes. It hasn't come yet, but that will change the dynamic.
Well, let me follow up on what you said about climate change, because he doesn't have an unalloyed reputation, at least among environmentalists, when it comes to this. He has allowed oil drilling and fracking, and there's some criticism about the sort of market mechanisms, cap and trade, for example, from the environmental side. So what is his environmental record when it comes to protecting the air and water?
You know, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out the criticism that he gets from people on fracking. And it's real. They followed him to Germany. They protested him there. I think that his show in San Francisco will probably have huge demonstrations by people in California who oppose fracking. And certainly there are some environmentalists who criticize him on CEQA. He hasn't done the reforms there that he himself had said he'd wanted to. He never could get it done. But that all being said, if you talk to mainstream, I think, people who care about climate change, people like Al Gore, Bloomberg, Tom Hayden before he died, they would say that even if they have these disagreements with him on particular issues, in America, anyway, there's probably at the moment no better spokesperson for the climate change agenda than Jerry Brown. And it's just, I think he has a push and a presence internationally that supersedes very real concerns that some environmentalists have about some of his positions on fracking.
And what about fiscally? Of course, he's got this reputation as a fiscal moderate, if you will, or he has been fiscally prudent. And certainly he leaves a big budget surplus of, around $6 billion. However, he was not able to tame the public employee pensions, which are ballooning. And I think a lot of fiscal conservatives are very concerned about what that might do to the state's finances going forward.
Definitely. Certainly not to the degree that Brown said he would have liked. And that's on him. He's been here now 8 years. He could have had those negotiations. He has a Democratic legislature. Presumably he could have given them something else. It's fair to fault him for that. And don't Republicans just hate it when they hear other Republicans talk about Brown being the adult in the room? Because at least many Republicans will say, he's a Democrat. But the truth is, he did cut spending when he came into office to go along with the taxes that he raised. So there was a measure of fiscal prudence there. And I think that Brown would tell you that the budget surplus is a result of discipline during his governorship. It's also a result simply of the circumstances of the economy. And he warns a recession is looming. He knows his public approval ratings are as much about these kind of broader forces than they are about anything one governor does. So I mm-hmm. think he has a realistic assessment of what he's accomplished there.
David Siders writes about California politics for Politico. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brown has given more State of the State addresses than any other governor in California history. Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon even made a joke about it.
It is quite an honor to be part of Governor Brown's 16th and final, we think, State of the State address. I'm assuming it's the final one.
All right. Joining us now, Sherry Bebich Jeffy. She's studied the governorship of California for decades, political science professor at USC. Hi there.
Hi there, Madeline. I love that 4 decades. Oh, my God.
Well, just to prove that you have gravitas to talk about what we're going to talk about, which is Brown's history, how would you compare his speech today to ones that he perhaps gave in the 70s?
I think it's one of his best, if not his best. I will always remember the first of his State of the State addresses. I was up in the chamber for that one. And as I recall, it was something like 7 or 9 minutes long. I mean, there was dead silence for a second after he finished. I think people weren't really sure he was done. But this one was, it was long. And I think it may be the longest or one of the longest he's ever given. But it was also thought through. It was Jerry Brown talking about what he cared about, sometimes very deeply in the weeds, but always there was that feeling that he had thought through what A, he wanted to do, B, what he did, and what he wanted his message, his final State of the State message to be.
Okay, well, let's put Brown in context and talk about him from the 70s onward. And, you know, he was, of course, called Governor Moonbeam. But in general, he has always preached the gospel of fiscal restraint. I just want to play a quick clip of tape of him from 1976.
Sure.
I'm a little tight in some of my budgets. You've heard about that. Well, that's not because I'm conservative. It's because I'm cheap.
Okay. So, yeah, he famously, you know, flies coach and all that kind of stuff. But is he really a fiscal conservative?
Yeah, I think he is.
Yeah.
I think he is. And he has the luxury to be able to be one because our economy is doing so well. I mean, he's got more money to say, hold on, we need a rainy day fund.
Right. So he leaves California with a surplus of more than $6 billion as of this moment. And but also, generally, the economy in the United States is doing really well. And, you know, we do rely on our, you know, the vagaries of our tax system, which relies on the wealth of high income individuals. So
right.
When they're doing well, we do well. And when they're doing poorly, we do poorly. So how much credit can he actually take for the fiscal health of California?
As much as he cares to.
I mean, in reality, like how much should we credit
well,
him?
Well, I mean, so having left a surplus, he can certainly take some credit for giving the next governor a cushion, if you will. But, you know, if the economy doesn't do well and the economy doesn't get turned around, you know, no governor can take credit. Every governor will.
All right. So he has had a lot of jobs, of jobs. He's governor twice. He was attorney general. He was the mayor of Oakland. He was secretary of state. He was the state Democratic Party chairman. And he ran for president not once, not twice, but three times. Why do you think his national profile didn't catch on? Why do you think he didn't become a national politician?
He was for about a minute and a half when he was first elected the first time. A national figure. He was the darling of the media for a little bit. He is again. And I think you can make the argument that when the media pays attention to you, you have a better chance of becoming a national figure. I don't know if you remember that at one point when he was dating Linda Ronstadt, he was a national figure. He made the cover of Time magazine when he and Linda toured Africa. Ask the media why he didn't become a national figure. I can tell you if my opinion with regard to his presidential races was he didn't really have a top-notch campaign. He didn't really focus on a message that resonated, if you will. And he still reeked of the reputation as Governor Moonbeam. He's not Governor Moonbeam anymore.
And how would you compare him to his father in terms of his achievements, in terms of his legacy?
For the first term, the first tenure, I guess is the better, more accurate word, it appeared to me as though Jerry Brown was attempting to dismantle his father's legacy.
In what way?
In the fact that he cut the state budget, in the fact that he was very hard on higher education. We saw very little concern with the issue of water, which was one of his dad's primary legacies, the State Water Project. What I have seen, and I hate to do political pop psychology, but I guess I've been forced to. What I have seen is that he has freed himself from that. And what he is talking about now is transportation, water, looking at the state as the golden state, calcium water storage, touting infrastructure, touting transportation.
But there's a big difference between touting and doing. And his father really, he accomplished so much. As you say, the California Aqueduct, the water project, the master plan for higher education, he transformed California.
Well, yes, and I will tell you that I'm not arguing that Jerry Brown is a better governor than his father was. I am simply saying that the times were different. The style of leadership was different. The political ecology was different. The demography was different. You know, yeah, both of them. What I have been saying is that when Jerry Brown first entered the governor's office, he appeared to be wanting to and trying to dismantle much of his father's legacy. That is not the case now.
Sherry Bebich-Jeffy, political science professor at USC. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, before we leave state politics, one more small item to tell you about. Very small, in fact. A scientist at the Natural History Museum of LA County has discovered the world's smallest fly. You know, like shoe fly, a fly, the insect. And because he found it, entomologist Dr. Brian Brown got to name it.
When I looked at it and I saw those big, bulging legs, front legs or arms, you might say, I realized there was only one person I could name it for.
I'm a cybernetic organism living tissue over a metal endoskeleton. My mission is to protect you.
Our 38th governor, of course. The name of the fly is, all right, I'm going to try to say this right in the first time around, Megapropodophora arnoldi. Yes, an homage to Arnold's biceps and really his oeuvre.
The fly is also a kind of terminator in that it's a parasitoid. It lays its eggs inside hosts, which are probably ants or termites. The eggs hatch and the larva then feeds on the inside of the body of the host, eventually killing it.
Oh, gross. Okay. The specimen was discovered in the Amazon where Dr. Brown has been doing research. He's discovered some 500 species of flies, and that's not easy.
Something this small, the only way we can find it is by looking through trap samples. So we put out traps in the forest. They're like tents with a collecting bottle at the top. Collecting bottles have alcohol in them, and they gather the insect specimens. We take the catch in alcohol back to the laboratory, and we look through it under high-powered microscopes, and that's how we were able to find this fly.
The fly's name, I'm not going to say it again, became official yesterday when Brown's research was published, and he got to honor a childhood idol.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was somebody I knew about when I was younger and who wrote books on weightlifting and things that interested a teenage person who was maybe on the skinny side. So his autobiography was a book I had, one that inspired me to get into weightlifting, at least to some extent, to try and make myself not just a scrawny teenager.
Brian Brown of the LA County Museum of Natural History, the man who discovered a new fly and named it after his childhood hero, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Coming up, America first. That's President Trump's message at Davos. The Davos man is not impressed. You can't fight globalism. Well, you can try, but you probably won't win. We'll have that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The world's business and political leaders are in the Swiss resort town of Davos for the annual World Economic Forum meeting. President Trump has also arrived to, quote, tell the world how great America is and is doing, as he tweeted before he left. He met today with Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu and with British Prime Minister Theresa May, with whom he has had a frosty relationship. But many of the world's leaders have rejected the president's America First attitude. In a speech yesterday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said protectionism was not the answer, and she called right-wing populism a poison. Many countries have moved forward with trade agreements that do not include the United States. And here to talk about all of this is Peter Goodman. He is European economics correspondent for The New York Times in Davos right now. Hi there.
Hey. How are you?
Great. Well, how would you compare the overall sentiment in Davos this year to last year?
Well, I mean, this year it's really exuberant. I mean, last year, the Davos crowd, and let's be clear on who we're talking about. I mean, there are some very earnest non-governmental organizations, human rights groups, diplomats. But, you know, the people who really pay the bills here are investment bankers, hedge fund managers, private equity overseers, and masters of finance, along with a lot of heads of state. And last year at this time, they were feeling like they were in the crosshairs of a global insurrection. I mean, Trump was about to be inaugurated, and he was essentially vowing to use the Oval Office as a kind of war room in mounting attacks against multilateral institutions like the World Trade Organization, NATO, the Paris Climate Accord. Marine Le Pen was doing well in the polls in France. And, of course, Britain had voted a few months earlier to abandon the European Union. And there was a real feeling of, boy, you know, capitalism's got a problem. I mean, a lot of people have been left out of the benefits of economic growth. And a lot of those people are angry, and the pitchforks are at the gate. This year, it looks like to the moneyed class here in Davos, Trump, despite a lot of rhetoric about blowing up trade deals, hasn't actually done that much. He's given them an enormous tax cut whose largesse has mainly flowed to corporations and to wealthy people. They don't love the Twitter battles with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un over who's got a bigger nuclear button. But they sort of tune that out as noise, and they're focused on the fact that every major part of the world economy is now growing at once. So there's a pretty exuberant mood here.
So despite these kind of obvious rebukes by the German chancellor, by Theresa May, by Emmanuel Macron of France, they're, you know, behind the scenes pretty okay with the way things have shaped up?
No. I mean, the European leaders are not okay. And moreover, some business leaders will tell you that they are genuinely concerned about the Trump rhetoric on trade. I mean, I met today with the European Union trade minister who said she's extremely concerned that the Trump administration is blocking the naming of judges to the World Trade Organization. She's concerned about the prospect of a trade war with China, concerned about the ramifications if the U.S. pulls out of NAFTA. I mean, there are concerns, and certainly Merkel, Macron, Paolo Gentiloni of Italy, you know, all spoke very forcefully in speeches here about the need to rededicate the global community to global institutions, to free trade, and the way they cast it, you know, the mission is how do you use trade to generate growth, but then have the benefits of that growth flow to more people so you don't have this jobless epidemic, so you don't have economic inequality getting worse. And I mean, to that segment of the Davos crowd, Trump is very much of a threat, and a lot of the speeches that were given here by European leaders this week kind of resonated as a sort of pre-rebuttal of whatever it is Trump is going to say when he talks tomorrow.
And how effectively, though, is the Davos crowd and the European leaders, how effectively are they actually representing their citizens' interests? Because there might seem to be, or there did last year seem to be, as you say, this idea that capitalism has a problem, increasing nationalism in Europe, a fear of refugees, you know, infiltrating every corner of Europe. Are they, when they're talking about the promises of globalization?
Let's be careful with refugees infiltrating every corner of Europe. I mean, there's certainly a lot of right-wing politicians saying that refugees are infiltrating every corner of Europe. I mean, and it is certainly something that makes people uncomfortable who are not used to refugees in their midst. And it's a challenge that the very generous European social welfare model has to pay benefits for people who are less employable than the migrants who've arrived in past years. But, you know, this sense of crisis is really quite overblown. I mean, there's a lot of talk of supposed no-go zones in French cities, you know, Dutch cities. I mean, Trump actually got in trouble for saying something like that. And when you talk to Europeans, I mean, they will generally tell you that sort of talk is overblown.
So the people are not saying, oh, you know, we don't want this represented politically anymore. I mean, Merkel was in trouble not so long ago for supporting a broad refugee program.
Merkel, after the fall elections, you know, emerged in an inconclusive situation where she couldn't immediately form a coalition government. And the AfD, this right-wing anti-immigrant party, surged to 15% support in the German parliament. And that's certainly a force to be reckoned with. But let's remember, the apparent outcome of the coalition talks, I mean, Merkel's Christian Democratic Union will form a government with the Social Democratic Party. And that government is likely to be more pro-European and more likely to advance the European integration that Macron set out as his antidote to populism.
So when Trump steps on the stage tomorrow, will he be regarded, and America by proxy regarded, as, oh, an interesting, you know, sideshow, but we're going to go ahead with our plans, globalizing?
Yeah, I mean, Trump has been pursuing this America first doctrine. And while he's been doing that, the rest of the world has been getting on with its business. So the original countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this giant Pacific trade deal engineered by Obama that Trump pulled out of in his first week in office, turns out the other countries are going ahead with it, which means there's going to be a huge Pacific trade bloc that will lower barriers to trade throughout the region, and the U.S. will not be party to that. Japan recently struck a free trade deal with the European Union, which means that Japanese manufacturers will actually have much easier access to the European market than American producers. So, you know, while Trump has been pursuing a unilateralist America first policy, the rest of the world has been continuing to pursue integration.
So what does that mean practically? Can you give us an example? I mean, just this week he slapped tariffs on washing machines and solar panels. What does it mean for American manufacturers?
Well, I mean, in the case of solar panels and washing machines, it means that American consumers are going to pay more for solar panels and washing machines. It turns out there's an awful lot more people who make a living in America installing solar arrays, working for renewable energy companies, than there are people who make solar panels. So those companies will be at a price disadvantage as they're forced to pay higher prices for imported solar panels. I mean, it makes for a very nice photo op for the Trump administration, you know, much like, say, standing up for coal miners when you pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, and never mind that there really aren't many coal miners left in America. And what coal miners there are threatened by automation. I mean, there are lots of other vibrant, innovative industries that aren't benefited at all from that sort of protectionism. But, you know, let's remember, this is a president who has excelled at one thing, and that's reality television. And this is reality television economic policy.
Peter Goodman, European economics correspondent for The New York Times at Davos. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we'll find out which movies at Sundance are good enough or weird enough to make it out of Park City next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sundance wraps up on Sunday. This year's festival debuted in the wake of the Me Too movement. Harvey Weinstein was a longtime fixture at Sundance. He paid big bucks to acquire indie films. This time, of course, he was not in attendance. But Sundance has always been ahead of the curve in promoting new and underrepresented voices in filmmaking. Last year, Get Out, The Big Sick, Call Me By Your Name all made waves and now are up for Academy Awards. So what is the next big thing? Critic Amy Nicholson joins us now from Park City. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Great, thanks. Well, what are the big discussions happening at the festival this year? Are you seeing any themes?
You know, if I am seeing a theme, it feels like Sundance this year, the cliche has always been this is the film festival known for films about, you know, sad, hapless, middle-class white dudes wondering why the world doesn't love them more, which those movies can be great. Some of my favorite movies are those movies. But this year, it's almost impossible to not just stumble into a movie about a really fascinating female character.
Oh.
They're everywhere. Like, Sundance, I think, has made a big push this year to take the steps they've already been doing about promoting diverse voices and just go really far with it. And it's been phenomenal.
Okay, so what are some of the standouts?
Okay, my favorite movie so far, and I cannot wait for people to get to watch this, is by a brand new filmmaker named Boots Riley. He's a musician from Oakland. It's this film called Sorry to Bother You. And it has some of my favorite people in it, Lakeith Stanfield, Tessa Thompson, who was in Thor, Armie Hammer, playing this horrible tech bro. And this is just the sort of film you go to Sundance to see, because Sorry to Bother You is like this unhinged, really brilliant, really creatively directed comedy about like capitalism and unions and the art world. And it has like notes of Michel Gondry in it. It's just this singular, fascinating film. And you sit down and you just leave the theater being like, oh my God, we have a new voice in town.
And that's Boots Riley you're talking about.
That's Boots Riley. And he's, you know, a musician. I haven't even heard his stuff yet. And I want to go back and figure out everything he's ever done because he is really singular.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. And then you mentioned, you know, a lot of women featured films. What are some of the highlights there?
Well, one of the trends that we have is that we've been having these films here where they take a story we think we know about a character we think we understand, and they do this feminist version of it. So there's a film called Lizzie, which stars Chloe Sevigny as Lizzie Borden, the woman who killed her parents with an axe. And in this retelling, Lizzie Borden is not this murderess. She's this repressed woman who's in love with her housekeeper. And she's just literally slaying the patriarchy. I mean, this is Lizzie Borden done like ultra feminism.
But she did kill her mom too, right?
Yeah, well, her stepmom. And her stepmom's okay. Kind of a jerk in the film.
Kind of a Cinderella story, I guess. And then there's one I understand that kind of redoes Hamlet.
Yeah, that's Ophelia starring Daisy Ridley, you know, Rey from the Star Wars series, as Ophelia herself, picking up before Hamlet even comes back from his studies abroad. And she's a lady in waiting who gets to spend a lot more time with Gertrude. You get to see Gertrude's romance kind of build with Hamlet's uncle. And it's this idea that Ophelia isn't just this unhinged, depressive, crazy woman who drowns herself. She is the most sensible person in the film. And she's the one trying to really warn everybody, almost more of a Cassandra figure, that what they're doing, battling each other for revenge, this really masculine version of an eye for an eye, is not going to help the world at all. And, you know, Daisy Ridley is still, I think, finding her legs as an actress. And she plays Ophelia with this kind of heroic, broad-shouldered blankness that doesn't totally work, but there's something in the film that actually really weaves in and out of the Shakespearean play pretty well until the end, when it also goes for like gigantic feminist fist-pumping, clapping, yeah, down with everybody, rah-rah endings.
Okay, I want to play a clip of tape from a trailer from a movie called Assassination Nation. It sold for more than $10 million, so far the biggest deal of the festival. Here's a clip from the trailer.
I read this quote from this writer whose name I forget, but it said something like, 10% of the population is cruel, and 10% is merciful, and the other 80% can be swayed in either direction. I'm also pretty sure that that writer has never seen a World Star Fight vid, or 4chan, or Twitter.
Okay, what is this movie about?
So Assassination Nation, I was actually at the midnight movie right before it sold for $10 million, watching the crowd that screamed and made them think this was a $10 million film, which I'm a little unconvinced about. This is an update of the Salem Witch Trials, of all things, where it's set in a suburb called Salem. And it's about these teenage girls who are kind of mean girls using Snapchat, Twitter to insult people. And then a mysterious hacker in the town begins hacking into everybody's accounts and revealing all their dirty secrets. And it starts with the mayor, who's disgraced, then the principal, who is disgraced. And it gets into that online pile-on culture where some of the things people are being accused of aren't really what they did, but nobody will listen to reason. And then it goes in the final act from being this screed about the internet to another, like, hey, a bunch of girls grab guns and start taking down the system movie. We really do have a theme, Madeline. And the four teenage girls become this squadron, basically, where the witches fight back against the men who are blaming them for tempting them by sending them nude selfies. It gets a little bit confusing.
I understand there's like a weird trigger warning or parental advisory at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, the trigger warning is amazing. I think it warns you that there's going to be fragile male egos, violence, blood, bloodshed, a bunch of ridiculous things. People were hooting right when that started, and I think that just set the tone.
Okay, and then the $10 million followed shortly thereafter that. All right, another horror film being talked about this year is Hereditary, starring Toni Collette. What's that about?
Oh, this film is great. I mean, if we are seeing a secondary trend with the films that you name-checked earlier that are all Oscar consideration, it's people really looking at these low-budget horror films, high-concept films, and turning in great performances. I mean, Toni Collette is one of our greatest actresses, and here she is in a horror film playing this woman whose mother dies at the start, and then their family gets more and more tragedies start to pile on, and she gets more and more unhinged. And she's an artist who makes little miniature dollhouses, and she starts representing the tragedies that are happening to her family in there. And then she just starts screaming and going crazy, and it's totally wild. A bunch of us piled into the midnight movie of this last night because we were all afraid to walk home in the snow by ourselves. Because also, Hereditary does sort of a nasty thing. They set it here in Park City just to terrify us.
Oh, of course. Well, of course. I think safe to say, whenever you see a dollhouse in a movie, it's up to no good.
Yeah, and wait till you see a dollhouse with beheaded people.
All right. Well, speaking of beheaded, at least figuratively, Harvey Weinstein used to be a huge power broker at Sundance, and you know his company would buy up a bunch of movies. So the fact that he's notably absent, or he's the Weinstein Company is as well, does that mean that there's a, you know, fewer movies being bought and sold?
I've been wondering about this, because what I've been able to see from this perspective is, you know, we've gone through a couple really big indie purchasing revolutions. We went through the Weinstein thing where they would show up into Park City, raise the bidding costs really high for everybody. And so these indie movies were going for a lot more money than maybe they would make back. And then right after that, we've had Netflix and Amazon raising up the prices in these like really intense bidding wars. And this year, neither one of those groups is doing that much buying. And it feels like prices, for the most part, Assassination Nation aside, have been dipping down. It feels like nobody quite knows what to bet on anymore. And I think that's kind of a thing that we're seeing across the board with the industry in general. Things like seeing a movie like Get Out get an Oscar nomination, which is incredible. That it feels like we're in the moment of seeing the future of indie film culture shift, and no one's quite sure how we're going to make money off of it, how it's going to work, but there's great stuff being made.
Yeah, I mean, Mudbound was at the festival last year, right? And then I, Tonya, right? Neon is in the running in terms of buying movies, and they buy up these indies like I, Tonya, which do well.
Yeah, Neon, I think, is one of the biggest purchasers this year, which I'm wondering how that works. Like, I've got my fingers crossed for them. They make really bold choices, and I want to make sure they don't spend all their money too fast and we don't get to keep them around longer.
Okay. So all in all, a good festival?
It is. I mean, to me so far, most of everything I've seen has been a B-, B+. You know, it's a lot of first-time filmmakers who have great ideas and can't quite stick the landing. But I enjoy that. It's exciting to me because you get to see the start of somebody's career. You feel like you're watching these voices that we're going to be talking about a lot on the show probably in 5 years.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks, Amy.
Well, thank you, Madeline.
That's Amy Nicholson. She is film critic for Variety this year at Sundance. Coming up, two newly cloned monkeys are raising the age-old question, paging Mary Shelley, when will we be able to clone humans? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Oh, that's the sound of some really cute baby monkeys. They're exploring their little plexiglass cage. They have some toys. One of them topples over. It's so cute. Maybe in the way the first scene of a horror movie can be cute. These monkeys, Zhang Zhang and Wawa, are clones. They were created with the same method used to clone Dolly the sheep 2 decades ago. It's the first time researchers have cloned a primate, and it could mean big changes for how drugs and other things are developed. The potential sci-fi storylines are a lot darker, of course. So to help us get our survival plans in order, or maybe just understand a little about the science here, we have Paul Knopfler on the line. He's professor at UC Davis Medical School and the author of GMO Sapiens, The Life-Changing Science of Designer Babies. Hello there.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what is the idea behind creating genetically identical monkeys? What would scientists want to use them for? What would they be useful for?
Well, I think the idea is that by having these monkeys that are genetically the same, there might be ways we can learn new things about genetic diseases in people. So one of the challenges with research of this kind is that, you know, for instance, all of us humans are so different genetically, and that's where having clones that are the same, you know, their DNA is the same, could be helpful for studying things like cancer or cystic fibrosis, you know, things with a strong tie to our DNA.
Right. But, you know, there's a lot of questions about doing experiments on primates. You know, a lot of Western countries, right, have moved away from that.
Right. That's true. There seems to be a trend away from that. And so while, for instance, I'm supportive of primate research up to a certain point and of certain kinds, one of my concerns about the new development of the clone monkeys is that it could expand that research a great deal. And, you know, perhaps, for instance, someone building on this technology might seek to make a lot of monkeys and expand research in an area where, you know, it's hard to say. We may or may not learn a lot of new things.
Yeah, but on the other hand, the promise could be great, right? Because what about for a disease like Alzheimer's? Could you more effectively experiment on primates than on rats?
Well, I don't know that it would be more effective, but it's probably more relevant to human Alzheimer's. You know, we are close relatives of the other primates, and like the ones that were cloned in this new paper. And so, you know, what's going on in our brain is much more similar to that of a monkey, even a clone monkey, than say a mouse or a rat. So there, you know, there is promise there. I'm just still trying to wrap my mind around whether this was really necessary, because you can obviously get more monkeys kind of the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. Well, so then is there another motive, do you think? Is it because they want to go one step closer to cloning humans?
I don't know. You know, it's not clear to me. I looked at the paper, and they seem primarily, the authors, that is, focused on, you know, how this might help advance knowledge of human disease. So I don't know if there's another motive. You know, sometimes as scientists, we get really excited about a certain goal and we just kind of go after it. And I know for many years, no one's been able to get cloning of monkeys to work. And so, you know, it probably feels really good for this team to have achieved something brand new. And at the same time, you know, many of us are kind of worried about what might come next.
Okay. What are you primarily worried about?
So my primary concern, and this is something I've been kind of following for years, is that there are some people who are excited about the idea of cloning people. And so that's going to be a really tough task. There's a lot of obstacles in the way. But this kind of paper, now we can clone monkeys, it might embolden some people who are sort of tending toward the rogue scientist, you know, path to be more likely, and maybe it wouldn't be next year, maybe it'd be a few more years down the road, but to give the human side of things a try. And so that really worries me for a bunch of reasons.
Yeah, I'm sure it worries lots of people for a bunch of reasons. Who is pursuing that or who's excited about it?
There have been different people over the years. Usually it's people who are kind of out there, I would say. A number of years ago, there was a group that said they actually had cloned a human. And I think that was later debunked. But just every now and then you hear about different people saying, wouldn't that be cool if we could clone ourselves or clone other people or clone Einstein or Justin Bieber or, you know.
Well, let's not go that far. I mean, but, you know, there are people who, let's say they lost a child and would very much like to have that child back.
I have a blog about different science, including stem cells. And at one point, I did get a question from one of the readers of my blog that asked me, could I clone their deceased child? So that's obviously a much more serious situation than talking about cloning a celebrity or something like that. And, you know, there are people out there who already are getting their pets cloned, you know, and there are people who suffer a serious loss, such as of a child, and maybe they think cloning would be a way to get over that, you know, real deep pain and loss. But I have to, you know, I have to point out that a clone wouldn't be the same person, right? They would be the same in a lot of ways, but they wouldn't be any more the same person than identical twins are the same person. So that's something, you know, that's sort of one of the myths sometimes floating around about cloning, is that it's, you know, it's exactly the same as you and would somehow be the same person, but it's not quite that simple.
And how would it actually work? Like, would you clone that person as a baby or as that person was when he or she died?
Yeah, so when you make a clone, you're starting over. And so you would have to go through a pregnancy. And when the clone arrives, it would just be a newborn baby. So if you're cloning, for instance, you know, a 30-year-old person, you don't get a 30-year-old clone, you get a baby. So that's another thing we sometimes see, like on TV or in movies, that the clone looks the same age, you know, as the original, but that wouldn't be the case.
Okay. And so I guess also in our conspiracy-minded mentality, what if we clone a bunch of these monkeys and then they escape?
So I would probably be more concerned for the monkeys just out in the world, you know, maybe getting into mischief or getting hurt or something like that. I don't think they would pose any kind of risk. These particular kind of monkey, you never know, you know, with an animal there could be risks to people, but I don't think it would be any different than, say, a monkey escaping from the zoo.
So they wouldn't, I mean, in terms of reproducing, like, they wouldn't then spread these clone genes throughout and it would be a problem?
If they were able to escape and then, you know, be in a habitat where there are others of the same species, they could breed together. But I'm not, as far as I know, I don't think these particular clone monkeys, it's not like, at least so far, they don't have any like unusual genetic thing about them that would make them risky or anything. But that does raise another point, and that is that these researchers and others who have been talking about this paper mentioned using this new technology called CRISPR, where you can edit genes. So they did talk about genetically changing the clone monkeys and, you know, perhaps mutating a certain gene to see what happens. And so in that case, you know, we wouldn't want those monkeys to escape. And as far as I know, it's pretty rare for primates to escape. And even if they did, they probably wouldn't be near a natural habitat. But you never know, you know.
They would just rampage through our cities, basically, is what you're saying.
These particular guys, they're pretty little. And as you said, they're kind of more on the cute side than on the, scary
for now.
Side.
For now. Okay. Paul Knopfler, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Paul Knopfler, he's the author of GMO Sapiens, The Life-Changing Science of Designer Babies. Christian Bordahl.
Hey there, Madeline Brand.
Or the clone of Christian Bordahl.
No, it's me. It's the real thing, I promise. I did ask our listeners what they think about the idea of human cloning. And Marika Gerard says, just think, Trump could clone himself. David O'Grady, following up on that idea, says, couldn't humanity have sorted this out before David Bowie died? A bit late for us now.
Yeah.
I ran a Twitter poll. 22% say yes, go ahead, but just as long as it's safe. 16% said only for medical reasons. 44% said it should never happen. And 18% are not sure.
Okay. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. I'm Bran. I'll clone myself and see you tomorrow.